ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Wait, you don't need that new dress, those new sneakers. You need a hug. So says the fashion activist and writer Aja Barber in her excoriating book Consumed. She unpicks the global fashion industry one thread at a time. Yeah, we're meeting Aja in this episode of Big Ideas. This is your front row seat to the best live events with big thinkers. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Did you know Australia is the second highest consumer of textiles per person in the world after the USA? I did not know that. Apparently, we buy an average of 56 items of clothing every year and send 23 kilos to landfill. What? So if you're curious to really understand where your clothes come from, who sews them, what their life is like, and what happens after you move on to the next fashion trend, this episode is full of eye-opening truths that will blow your mind. From the All About Women Festival at Sydney Opera House, let's join journalist and popular TV presenter Jan Fran now for her recent conversation with writer, stylist, consultant and contributing editor with LUK, Aja Barber.
Hello! Thanks! How are we going? Look at all of these presumably ethically dressed people. You had to check your Shein at the door. That's what the security's there for. Hello, I am Jan Fran. Welcome to this session. It is so lovely to have so many of you here with us today. You all know why you're here. We're slowing down fast fashion. So many of you will know that that is a subject matter that is close to my heart. I have for many years not bought new clothes, and I thought that I knew everything that I needed to know about the fashion industry and its ills, and that was until I came across the work of Aja Barber. So Aja, the person that you are here to see, is somebody who knows the industry in and out, but not only that, is able to think deeply about the repercussions, about some of the machinations behind the industry itself, and to really delve into topics that you think have nothing to do with fashion, but actually have everything to do with fashion. So I am so overjoyed to be able to be in this conversation with her. And without further ado, please welcome Aja Barber to the stage.
Wow.
How was your flight?
Oh my God. I'm glad you're all here because I don't plan on doing that again soon.
It's funny, I deliberately didn't intro you while I was up here because I'm like, I don't know what the best way to introduce you would be because you do so many things. So I might just get you.
Internet to, annoyance.
Internet annoyance. I mean, that was
ruins your fun.
But I might get you to kind of like introduce yourself to people. Who are you and why are you here?
Yeah, I'm a writer and I talk about the fashion industry and I talk about it from the perspective of someone who absolutely loves fashion. I think people are like, you just don't want me to buy anything. And that's not true. I don't want you to buy things where people have been exploited and harmed to make the thing. And we can actually get around that in many, many ways. But because we've been told to look the other way, you know, it's okay. It's fine. Look, here's a picture of like a South Asian woman smiling, random stock image. It's perfectly fine. And I want us to think a little bit deeper about this. So I basically exist on the internet to remind you that when you next scroll and somebody's trying to sell you a dress, was the person who made that dress treated fairly? Were they paid fairly? Why do you even want to buy that dress? Is there some sort of pernicious force on the internet that is almost sort of baiting you into like spending your hard-earned money when maybe you don't even need that dress? Maybe you need a hug. Maybe you need to hang out with a friend. Maybe you need to put your phone down. Maybe you're surrounded by shitheads and you need to like get out of that space. Maybe you don't need that dress. I want you to think deeper about these issues and what is being sold to you through your phone on the internet, because it's a pretty weird world out there and it can be beautiful in so many ways. But what's happened that I've seen in the last 20 years, and this is the benefit of being a grandmom on Instagram, is I've seen all of these systems speed up, right? I've seen these systems grow into what they are today, and that couldn't happen without social media. It wasn't like that before because we didn't have these little phones. So it's time for those of us who have the platforms on the little phones to start talking about the systems that we're surrounded by.
I feel like that's a great campaign slogan. Maybe you don't need that dress. Maybe you need a hug.
Yeah. You know, because that was what I needed in my 20s. And that's the thing. I'm never going to sit up here and be like, oh, well, you know, I just wear all ethical clothing and that makes me better than anyone. No, I was the problem.
Yeah, okay, so, but like you were the problem, but obviously there was a pivot. Like, what was that pivot
We do
point?
That thing in our society, right, where we see a problem, we're like, oh, God, I don't want to be a part of this, so I'm going to pretend like I was never the problem. And it doesn't help us. It helps us actually to talk about the journey because it helps other people. But I was definitely the problem. And there wasn't a particular moment at all. There was just a weird feeling that, like, I don't know. How are they making a dress for $5 when I get paid $5 an hour and I can't make that dress?
Yeah.
That feeling was always there. There was always a feeling of, but why are we okay with people in other countries making terrible wages? That feeling was always there and I couldn't fight it. But also seeing the price of clothing completely go down within my lifetime while everything went up. That was also a part of it. I've always been a curious person. I've always been someone who likes to make things. I'm not good at sewing. Not that good at knitting either. I do it, but I'm not good at it. How is it that a brand can make something so intricate and so beautiful that I know that I couldn't make for less money than the fabric even cost at the store? There are all these like real common sense moments that we have to like turn off in our head in order to participate in consumerism. We have to switch it off. And I'm here to help you switch that right back on.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about fast fashion, like what, just kind of set us a bit of a scene of like how big is the issue and what are we talking about? Because it's fast fashion. And then in the last few years, there just seems to be faster fashion.
Yeah. So I would say it's so big that it's, I don't have the statistic in my head, so don't quote me on this one, but I think it's something like 90% of the money we spend on apparel goes to 20 companies. Look it up after the talk is over, but I'm pretty sure it's a huge chunk of money that's going to something like 20 corporations. And when you have corporations that have that much of a hold on all of our wallets, who's going to regulate them? What's going to change if we don't change? And that's always the question. Is it, oh, well, is it the corporation's fault? Of course it's the corporation's fault. But if all of us as citizens, as humans, as people who keep these systems going are okay with it, nothing is going to change. No politician is going to regulate a system that all of its constituents are okay with. They're never going to be like, oh, yeah, you know that corporation everybody loves and buys from? I'm going to put some laws in there. Like, that is never going to happen. And so when we talk about, like, who's at fault, like, do not get me wrong. It is always the billionaires. But no one's going to stop them if we don't. No one is. No one's going to regulate them if we don't care. Nothing is going to change if we don't change.
Mm. There was a report that I read, I think it was like a UK-like parliament report, that said that by 2030, global apparel consumption is projected to rise by 63%, which is the equivalent of 500 billion extra T-shirts.
You're like, how could it even get there? Like,
if you go, I don't know what that number looks like.
I went and strolled like Newtown, and I was just like, there's so much stuff. Every time I go to a new city, I'm just like, okay, let's go check out what the shopping looks like. And all I can think is there is so much stuff on this planet. That's how I see it now, you know? And yeah, currently the fashion industry pumps out 100 billion garments a year. Now, keep in mind the human population is only like 7.8, 7.9. So it's like 13 times the human population. And if we really want to get into the nitty gritty, like 50% of the planet lives on $5.50 a day, which means that they aren't the ones buying trend-led clothing. So let's just have that population and you have a lot of clothing for a small percentage of the world.
Mm. So I've been sort of interested in the fashion industry and some of its impacts for many years now, but there were a bunch of things that I really only learned from engaging with your work and reading your book. And I'd always thought that the lifespan of a garment was sort of linear, like it starts here and it's made and it's produced and then it's bought here and it's used and then it's kind of thrown away here and it ends up here. But actually, it's a circle. It's not just a line.
It should be a circle. I mean, that we should be aiming for that. But I would say, yes, linear is how it looks. It's, created, exploitation there, assembled, exploitation there, sold to us in this room, and then donated or dumped. And so, yeah, it is linear. But what we would need effectively is a circular system. And currently, only 1% of textiles gets recycled.
Yeah. But what I meant is that, like, you get resources are exploited from this country over here. They go through this process. They're sold to Americans and Australians.
Yes, that's a circular system.
It's
a circular system of exploitation.
No, it's a shit circular system.
From start to finish, poor black and brown people in the global south are exploited most in this system. The resources are exploited. The labor is exploited. The product is consumed, and then it is dumped right back in the global south or in a landfill, which coincidentally, the landfills of the U.S., there's research showing that they are often built in brown and black neighborhoods. Interesting that. So yeah, from start to finish, it's definitely circular in its harm of marginalized people.
Yeah. The other thing that I took away from your book that I hadn't really sort of thought about before was the idea of frivolity. And fashion is often kind of thought of as, it's a little bit frivolous, it's just fashion, which I thought was a way of really kind of not engaging with the craft of it and the art of it. But actually, it kind of ends up being a silencing mechanism or like obscuring the deeper reality so we don't talk about it as much.
Let's make it seem frivolous and silly because it's women's stuff.
Yeah.
that's really at the heart of it. Oh, it's silly. It's just, and we do it too. We're like, it's just a silly little dress, just a silly little purchase. And in devaluing the system, we're entirely able to look away from the harm of the system. We're also completely devaluing the beautiful labor that goes into it. We're devaluing an entire workforce. We're devaluing a system that literally keeps global economies going. Like, if all of this came to a screeching halt tomorrow, economies would fail, So, we devalue it because of patriarchy at the root of it. And, let's make it seem frivolous and silly. We devalue it because the workforce behind making the clothing is 80% women. We devalue it because of colonialism. But at the end of the day, we have to value it because it is having a deep and profound impact on not just our planet, not just our fellow sisters, but our psyche as well.
Yeah. I feel like it benefits the... Yeah, totally. I mean, it just kind of benefits the billionaires that we keep devaluing
this.
That's
exactly who it benefits. Isn't that funny? I mean, when you look at the board of these big companies, what do you think you see? What, you think you see this room of people here? You think you see women? Yeah, you see one woman. She's like, hi, they just let me sit here for the photo. Oh.
Yeah. But in my head, I was like, the billionaires want us to value this because that's how they're making money off of us. But actually, it's the opposite.
And do not get me started on all the fast fashion companies and their International Women's Day posts.
No, stop.
Yay, women. Sweatshop clothing. Woo. T-shirt that someone was paid 3 pennies to make. Woo, women. Horrible.
Yeah. There was also something else that I kind of picked up. And this is sort of a question that I get asked a lot, that because the fashion is so cheap, it means that it's accessible for everyone. And often when I kind of criticize the fashion industry, people say,
what sort of class system are we looking at when we devalue the entire labor force behind it? Who is everyone? Is it everyone in this room? Or is it everyone on the planet, including the women that you don't see that have made the clothing? How bullshit is it that we can literally completely ignore that labor force in that argument? We have to stop with this nonsense. It's nonsense. It is. It is absolute BS to say, it's really accessible when it only can exist if we exploit other women. That's not accessible. That is BS.
It's also BS because you see the marketing that goes behind selling the clothes of these major companies. They're marketed to middle-class women.
Yes, exactly.
That's who the target audience is.
I get that from other influencers. When I try and talk to people with platforms that sell sweatshop clothing, I'm like, so you're a rich woman. Why are you selling sweatshop clothes? And they're like, this is what my audience can afford. It's really classist to not sell them. And I'm just like, your audience is just like you. Your readership is just as middle class as you are, do not even pretend like they need you to sell them shite that they don't need. That is also BS.
Yeah. It's just a thing that they kind of tell themselves to.
And we all tell ourselves that. Like, I make this case all the time. When I was in my 20s, I definitely qualified as low income. I made like $14,000 a year in the DC area, which is poverty wages, not in all parts of the world, but in DC, that qualifies you as low income. I was still pissing away a lot of my money on clothing I didn't need made in sweatshops. So I was lying to myself. And even if I was low income, I still had resources. I still had access. I still had certain levels of privilege. Unfortunately, in this conversation, because we're so indoctrinated into consumerism, we really squeeze and manipulate rhetoric to fit our particular situation so we feel good about buying sweatshop clothing. And like, I know, I did it. I was the problem. It was me. But I think there's so much power in being able to look back and realize that when you know better, do better. That's really it. And I think it's perfectly okay to call bullshit on yourself. It's empowering to be able to do that. Because if we can't do that, we can't actually really change. You have to really be honest with yourself in a lot of ways. And it's really healthy to do that. And it's good. And you can do it with your friends.
Mm. Thank you, that one person.
Can I get an amen?
The other myth that I just want you to bust, I didn't intend to go down a myth-busting route here,
no,
but
it's so good. Let's get into it.
Because I hear these things all of the time.
And it's nonsense when you hear it, but you don't have the facts and
exactly.
figures. Yes.
I don't know why it's nonsense, but I know that
you know why it's nonsense. And we know it's nonsense when we're saying it ourselves. We're like, well, this is all I can afford. You've got like two shopping bags full of stuff you really didn't need.
Yeah. The other myth that I kind of keep hearing as a justification for this is that workers in Bangladesh, in India, in China, they're better off working and they're better off earning.
All right.
But I hear that all the time.
Here we go. This is where we get to the colonialist part of it. Who was the global superpower of cotton before colonialism? Who was making all the clothing? What was British colonialism in India about? It was about disrupting a powerful market. It was about the fact that India was in control of its own resources. Do we not think that a place like India, where all the cotton is grown, cannot get back to that place? Do we not think that we can maybe like decide that these corporations in our own countries do not need all of this power? Do we not think that we could maybe actually support companies that are in the global south, in these countries, already making cool clothing? You don't have to wait for Urban Outfitters to sell you a cool dress made in India. You can buy that directly from a company in India who pays their wages. And so this idea that all of these systems can only exist if a corporation from a foreign entity that has exploited everyone, you know, pays them is ridiculous. That is patent colonialism. It really is. And when you look at the history of resources and who has had resources and access until other countries have arrived with, you know, gunpowder and all sorts of horrible things, you begin to realize that, like, this is still a lie we tell ourselves. It is perfectly okay for fashion industries in the global south to thrive, and we can be a part of that. We can be a part of that by making sure that we buy from companies that actually do pay people fair wages. And when we start to challenge that system and supporting the people that do pay fair wages, you know, it's going to be slow, but eventually those companies can grow and they can challenge the people who aren't paying fair wages. When we start to give our money directly to people who are giving it directly to the people making the clothing, and that collective community power grows, that gives people more collective bargaining in other spaces. So this idea that all of these systems can only thrive and if an exploitative business is there is, once again, something we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel good.
Yeah. And I think the kind of follow-up to that is, oh, so you're just like going to stop paying all these people all of a sudden, like one day to the next, you're just going to make all of these millions of people out of the job.
No, I'm going to pay someone who's paying them better. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to continue to buy clothing and I'm going to feel good about the clothing I buy because I know that that money has gone directly into the pocket of the person that made the dress. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. But you also mentioned the word slow there.
You know, like... And I'm going to slow down because I think sometimes when people think about ethical fashion, they feel really overwhelmed because they're still thinking from a fast fashion mindset where we are buying one garment a week. On average, the average American buys 68 items of clothing a year, which is more than one garment a week. And that's an old stat. So I would think that that stat's probably gone up a lot. That was from like 2016. And so... this idea that I can't afford ethical shopping because it's really expensive. Well, yeah, if you're buying 68 garments a week, it will be really expensive. But if you're buying one summer dress when you need a summer dress, it actually isn't that expensive. There became a point for me where I was like, I can buy 5 dresses from H&M or I can buy one dress and have it for 10 years. And you know what? I knew all along which one the better choice was. I knew it, you know, but I had to... be honest with myself.
Yeah. You wrote your book Consumed in, I think, 2021 it came out. So yeah. Kind of like height of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We're a few years down the track now. I feel like the pandemic did something to our consumption, good.
Well, I think we became more polarized, right? A lot of us were sitting in our houses looking around going, holy crap, I have a lot of stuff. I know I was. I was just like... I'm supposed to be better at this. Look at this. There were weeks where I were just like the same two outfits. What was I dressing up for? And I think for a lot of us who maybe hadn't thought about these systems before we were suddenly stuck inside, started to think a lot about it. And I noticed that because my following grew. And I thought, okay, that's really cool. But I think people that did not want to think about this system, do not want to think about this system, were also sitting in their house freaking out. I can't see my friends. I can't do the things I normally do. This is really uncomfortable. This is really terrible. But I found this great website called Shein where I can buy 100 items of clothing. Isn't that cool? You know what? I'll just buy 100 items of clothing that I'm not going to wear anywhere because I'm not going anywhere, but I'll just do it anyways. So I think we became more polarized. I think some people were like, you know what? I got to stop this shit. And like, more power to you. That's awesome. And you end up never going back. You're like, wow, that was ridiculous. That was what it was like for me, and I think that's what it's like for a lot of people. So you have the people on the site that go in this direction.
So the people
awesome.
Spending time in their own home
the
realize how much stuff
the people
they have
that are
in
slowing down,
home.
The people that are like, I have a lot of books, I have a lot of clothes, I have a lot of everything. We also saw in London people just dumping things outside of charity shops because the charity shops weren't open. And it's like suddenly you're confronted with your stuff. And instead of being mindful about it, you're just going to throw it all in a bin bag, leave it in front of a charity shop where it ends up all over the street. Beautiful. So you have, you know, people being really mindful and then you have people not being mindful at all and going in the opposite direction. So unfortunately, we're going to have to really spread this conversation to reach across the aisle and drag more of them into the direction that we have decided to go in.
Yeah. If you reflect back on the last few years, what do you think has been sort of like the fuel of the excess consumption that we've been...
Social media. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there's a New York Times profile from a few years back where they talk to teenagers and like a lot of the teenagers they survey say that like once something's been seen on social media, it's considered old or they don't feel good wearing the same thing twice on social media. We have to start normalizing a different message. And we have to start talking to young people about this stuff because it's pernicious. It's way more pernicious than it was for us. We were lucky not to grow up without some of this, but with the prevalence of buy now, pay later, you know, stuff like that, we're really seeing this new and extreme normalization of debt to buy things that you don't even need, you know? And so this conversation has to expand beyond this room, because the systems that are out there are getting our youth. And if we don't put the clamp down on that, changing the system is going to be a whole lot harder. But also, I think it can be better for everyone if we start talking to young people about this. Like, I think about the holiday season and how hard it is on parents, how hard it is that you've got these systems of consumerism where your kid is asking for things and asking for things. And then you've got, you know, whatever you celebrate. You might have, you know, the myth of Santa Claus, where it's like, I remember thinking when I was a kid, because I was never really buying Santa Claus, that like, I'm getting the feeling that my parents are actually behind this and buying the stuff. And that's great. But like telling kids, oh, well, you're good. So like Santa Claus bought you a lot of stuff. What if your parents poor? Does that mean you're a bad kid? You know? So like, I think that if we can really start talking to kids about consumerism and getting this message farther, it's going to be better for us all. I mean, when I think about my own path to being a fast fashion shopper, I was so ripe for the taking because I grew up being made fun of for my clothing. I grew up in a upper wealthy area, lower middle class, never having the right clothing, never fitting in, never being invited to subsequently sit at that lunch table with that group of snobs that were mean to me, thinking that maybe if I just had like a t-shirt from the Gap, they'd be nice to me. And that's how it starts. And so if we can really start talking to children about this stuff and younger kids about it, and not just this, but also debt, you know, debt is one of those things where it's like the all-American way that's now like spreading to all sorts of other corners of the planet. And it's a horrible thing. And we need to start talking to kids about all of these systems if we really want to fix it.
Do you have a way to do that? Because actually there's a question from somebody here in the audience. Thank you. Great question. That says like, how would you advise parents of preteens to help them kind of start building an awareness around fast fashion?
Like, I think we have to really get this, some of the stuff in the school system on the curriculum. How is clothing made? You know, when I was growing up, we had home ec, and I think that that's kind of disappearing. Well, they called it modern teen living. And I think it's kind of disappearing now. And I think we actually need to bring that back so people know the skills and labor that go into making things so that people sort of understand it. I think it can't just be on parents. I think we actually do need some of this stuff in schools.
It's funny you telling that story about, you know, wanting to kind of fit in with the popular crowd. Like it does come back
through clothing.
Through your clothing. Yeah. Like you don't need that dress, you need a hug.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
That idea of feeling, you know, inadequate and that you can fix it with clothing. You can suddenly be successful. You can be respected. You can be, you know, all
Listen,
of these things.
I wanted a Birkin bag when I was in my 20s. I read about it in like Marie Claire or something. And I remember this woman saying like, I was on the wait list for 5 years. And I thought, if I start saving now, I can have a Birkin bag when I graduate. And like, I think they're so ugly. And I always have. I've always thought they're ugly. They look like little mini luggage. I'm sorry. I actually love what some of the stuff that Hermes does. Birkins are ugly. But I wanted one because what it said about me, I'm a young black woman in a very white world going into white business spaces and I want people to treat me well. That's why I wanted the bag, not because it was pretty.
Yeah. How was that for you? Because you talk about it a little bit in your book, you know, going into the fashion industry, and it is a sort of predominantly white industry. And you are an American, but you live in London, so there's also that context.
Yeah, so my experience in the UK was awesome. I found a small streetwear label who is a graphic design house who has done the cover and illustrations in your book. And this is 20 years ago, but they made T-shirts. And they did it in a way that was so good. They worked with good factories and we made really good clothing. And it was at the same time the rise of fast fashion. So, you know, people would come into our little store on Brick Lane and they would be like, why am I going to pay, you know, £25 for a T-shirt? And it's like, because it's really good cotton made in a nice factory in Portugal. That's how much it costs, you know? And I began to sort of see this justification even then. So working for this really small label was a great intro into the fashion industry. And then later I moved back to the States and I interned and freelanced for a magazine, and that was not a great experience. So I had like the highs and lows, but working for that streetwear label, to which I'm still very good friends with the owners of that label, was a beautiful experience into how fashion should be done. They were so ahead of the game. Like, we would never throw out a bolt of fabric. And that's what you need to realize for like small brands. Because I find people really sort of interrogate like small brands when we should be interrogating the big corporations. Like, leave the small guys alone. So we would never like throw out a bolt of fabric because we couldn't afford to. And this was 20 years ago. So we would just like zip up like some quick tote bags. And now, of course, we all have a tote bag problem. But 20 years ago, nobody was doing that. It was like, what are we going to do with this? Okay, well, let's stop using plastic bags. We'll just make these totes really quickly. And you'd see people carrying them all around East London, which was quite lovely. Or we used to have a t-shirt printing press. This was 20 years ago, and a screen printing press. And you could come in and pick out a t-shirt, a color, a size, and then we would like print a design onto it for you. And now I see that like Primark and Oxford Circus does that, but like we did it 20 years ago, you know? So we were really sort of ahead of like a lot of the market that you see today. And it was a great experience, but working for the magazine was not.
Yeah. I came home one day because anytime you go to events, you get a tote bag.
Yeah.
And it's full of God knows what. And I came home one day and like my partner was like, saw me walking to the door with the tote bag. And he's like, no.
That's Steve. Steve is in here. And Steve will attest every time he sees me with another tote bag, he's like, no, take it away. Take it away. Can you please leave that behind? Do not bring that in. No, it's out of control.
It's out of control.
It's really
out
of control.
I got one hanger. Like there's this one particular hanger that I put the tote bags on. It's full.
Yeah.
I can't hang any more tote bags on that hanger.
It's like sagging to the ground.
It's sagging
yeah,
to the ground.
Yeah, no, totally. Now everybody's like, here's a free cotton tote. And you're like, oh. And I do suspect that the tote bag problem is definitely going to be a thing in Ghana
yeah.
that we now see as well.
But see, that sort of sprung up as like, oh, it's a tote bag.
It's a solution. Until everybody starts doing it and we start doing it to the tune of 4 billion tote bags a year.
Yeah.
Now it's a problem.
The one thing I wanted to talk about, because I know that probably a lot of members of the audience here do this. I do this all the time. I shop at op shops.
Yeah.
And I not only shop at op shops, but I shop at op shops and I also give clothes to op shops because I don't want to throw them away. I want them to be recycled. What's your view on that? How do you kind of process the good, the bad, and the ugly?
I think one of the best exercises we can have for our stuff is to really, really, really think thoughtfully about the end of the life cycle. So for me, when I have, you know, a closet clean out, I do about 5 different things before it goes to the charity shop. I normally ask around my friendship group if anybody wants something. I have held clothing swaps before. I love doing that. I sell whatever can be sold. I do these things so I think about the process of my stuff. I think the solution of just putting everything into a charity bag and making it someone else's problem, that's actually not helping us. I'm not going to say don't give to a charity. That is not my message. But the amount of stuff that charities are receiving is now an ecological problem. And I think we have to be honest with ourselves about it. So when we sort of thoughtfully send things in different directions, what it does for me is the next time I'm in a store and I'm thinking about buying something, I have to ask myself, what's going to happen to this at the end of his life cycle? If it's a garment, will anybody else want this garment if I decide that I no longer want it?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, you leave it on the rack and you walk away. That's really it. You've got to start. We can't just have this solution where we dump our stuff on someone else. And that's great. Like shopping at charities, perfect. Donating to charities, cool. But we have to be thoughtful about it. If I donate something to a charity, I try and make sure it's in season so it can be sold quickly. No stains, no rips, no tears. The buttons have to be on. The zipper has to work. It has to be something that is, you know, doesn't have to be the height of trends, but it should be still kind of something that, would I walk into this shop and want to buy this garment? And if the answer is no, then no one else probably wants it either. And thinking about these things when we're at the till and we're about to check out is going to be so great for how we buy and consume, you know? And so taking away the option of just give it to a charity shop really has us thinking a little bit deeper about like all of these systems and like what we're buying and why. So yeah, I do a lot of different things, but I buy, I would say maybe 60-70% of my wardrobe is secondhand now.
Yeah.
I love it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love it too. But I think it requires a bit of a sort of a mental shift. One.
You have to slow down. You're not going to just walk in and be oh, do you have that in another size and can I get it in purple?
Yeah. It is absolutely the practice of slowing down. And sometimes you're going to go in there and you're going to see an item of clothing and it is going to be missing a button and the zipper's not going to work properly and it's going to be too long and it's going to be too big or too small. And so you might then have to spend more time and money taking it in, taking it out, doing whatever you need to do with it.
But it has good bones. It has good structure.
But what is actually required in that moment is patience.
Yes.
That's what trips people up, I find, when they want to buy secondhand, is the patient element of it. Because, like, they go in, they see something they like, and they're like, oh, I like this, I saw this, I buy this. But it's not always going to be that way. You're going to come up against the challenge of actually needing to wait. And a lot of people don't want to do that.
Even like waiting on eBay. I mean, I think part of it is fast fashion has gotten us so away from, like, knowing our personal style, knowing what we really like, because you're having a lot of stuff pushed at you. Just like, wear this color, wear this trend, cold shoulder top, you want this, you want that. Maybe you don't want any of that stuff. So it's pushed us away from this idea of thinking about, like, what is my style? What is it that I like, you know? And once we get back to that, it really narrows down what you're purchasing. I can go into a store, look around and go, yep, nothing for me here, and get out. And I think we've gotten to this place where we go into a store and it's like, okay, I guess I have to buy something, but you actually don't. And when you start to like slow down and do more like shopping online, shopping secondhand, your choices are a lot more limited, but when you do make a choice, it's a lot more considered, which means it's probably going to stay in your wardrobe for a lot longer.
And sometimes you just have to put up with it. Like I haven't bought new clothes in 5 years, and every pair of pants that I buy at the op shop is too tight. It's like you're getting a pap smear just walking around. It's not great. But I just, you know, you're like, well, this is the price that I have to pay for wearing, you know, sometimes.
Sometimes I also will find, right, that like I'm be like, oh, I gotta clean out my closet. Like, I'm just not wearing this thing. And then I take it out and move it to the front of my closet. And then I'm like, let me just try it on. And then I'm like, maybe I'll wear it today. And then do you ever do like this, the rediscovery of like something? Yeah. And then like you start to wear it a lot and then it like rips in the armpit and you're like, damn, I was just getting back into that again. So that happens too, I think. But it's a slowing down process where when you're in a cycle of constant consumption, you're just never going to get around to that at all. Because why would you? You can just buy something new, you know?
One of the kind of challenges that I face is not necessarily around clothes, but it's around other textiles. So sheets, clothes that you wouldn't donate to an op shop, like underwear, singlets, stockings, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, underwear, I'm just like, just throw it away. But there are some things where you're just not going to be, you're not going to be able to recycle that and no one wants used underpants.
Yeah, there is going to be textiles.
There's going to be textiles that will be waste. That's just it, you know?
Yeah, but where do you, because I now just have a bag of these kind of like clothes. They might even be pillowcases.
This is where we need legislation. We cannot like just, you know, group hug our way out of that one. We need legislation. That's it. We need to have systems in place. And we can actually have them if we get our governments to charge the fast fashion companies to pay for them. That's something called Extended Producer Responsibility, EPR. And that looks like something like adding a penny tax or a 5p tax to every single fast fashion garment. And these companies have to pay for the end of the life of the product. Because once again, these are billion-dollar companies. So why are we paying for these systems when they're the ones making all the money?
I think there is something to that effect that has started happening in Australia.
Good.
But the fashion companies have to buy in. So they have to say, yep, we're in. And then I think also the transparency is them looking into themselves.
Yeah.
Which is another kind of issue with that.
The thing is, when we start to like really change these systems, we really can like get a few bullet points in with every, you know, swift change that we vote for and that we push for. But that looks like us advocating, and it has to happen. And that looks like a shift, a cultural shift.
While we're on the kind of point of, you know, what do we do? I just want to ask this question that's come through from a member of the audience. In terms of buying fast fashion brands, is it better, worse, good, bad to buy them secondhand?
I think, honestly, I get this all the time. Like, by all means, like, keep it out of a landfill.
Right.
You know, but also have a conversation about it with someone who compliments it. Like, I still have a lot of fast fashion from, because I bought a lot of clothing in my 20s. And people would be like, oh my God, I really like that. And I'm like, yeah, I like it too. But let me tell you, I do not like this company. And here's why. Yeah, I bought this at a different time. I bought it 10 years ago. And if you Google these exact words on eBay, I guarantee you, you'll probably find 50 of them because they made millions. And, you know, like, I'll still buy jeans from certain brands that need to sign the accord, but I will buy them on eBay because I will not hand them my money. And I also know that they overproduce because my friends in Ghana tell me. So why would I buy new denim from a brand that needs to make some changes and hand them my money when I can actually navigate something out of someone else's backyard and just wear it? I have no problem with people buying fast fashion secondhand. I think we should all be buying secondhand regardless of what the label is.
Mm. What other advice do you have for people who, you know, want to walk out of this room? How many of you shop secondhand? Just FYI. Let me just... Liars.
Yeah.
No, that's great. So
I still think we have a stigma about it in our society for sure. Like, I grew up wearing secondhand. I did not tell my little snot-nosed peers because that would have been another thing for them to make fun of me for. I think there's still stigma there. That's a hurdle that we're going to have to get through culturally in our society.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my cultural heritage is Lebanese and my mother would just never ever buy secondhand because it's shameful. It's like admitting that you're, you know, poor or that your standards are very low and you're not buying new stuff. And anytime like Easter or Christmas or whatever rolls around, it's the new item of clothing that you have that, you know, showcases how, I don't know, pious you are or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
no, culturally, it's not just, you know, in Lebanese culture, it's in so many different cultures. So I think all of us just need to keep wearing secondhand and normalizing it in our circles and spaces so that people know that it's okay. But yeah, I would have gotten made fun of for, I mean, I started buying my clothing on eBay in the year 2000. I was a university student, really dating myself here. And I just remember being like, I don't want to tell my peers because they're going to be really weird about it.
Mm.
And little did I know, look at the career path I have today.
Totally. But because so we've already got obviously a conscious audience here who's aware of some of the issues. I imagine there would be people who might want to leave here and do more or do something that they're not already doing or do something differently. What is your advice to people on what they should do in their everyday lives if they're already conscious of these issues and doing something?
Oh, I think you guys are already here, man. Honestly, like... Yeah, you're reading the books. I think we all need to read more books as a society. That is the one thing that I think is just going straight out the window and being replaced by social media. And I think we've got to get back to getting our nose in a book. Like, I look at this on social media and I look at all the different like platforms that exist. And it's so clear to me who reads and doesn't read. And I'm not saying like, oh, you have to read it. No, you can get it on an audiobook. But we have to start getting that information in because when we do, all areas of work that we do become a lot more dynamic, a lot more information informed. And I think that we're at this critical place where we really need to get back to the books. But look, if every person starts buying a few secondhand items a year, that is going to have a tremendous impact on the system. And if you're already doing that, right on. And if you already have a very full wardrobe, then the next new thing that comes in has to be from a company that pays everyone fair wages. That's it. If you already have clothing you can wear, then you don't need new things. And if they are new, we have to start looking for the signs that tell us that this is a good place to spend our money.
What's your view? This is a question from our audience that I also kind of want to know your opinion on. But what is your view on influencers on social media? who, particularly the ones that kind of, because there was that controversy a few months ago where a bunch of influencers were taken to the Shein in the factory. Yeah. <I'm
laughs> I got the most amount of press requests during that time period that I had all year. People were like, Haja, comment on these people that got fooled into going on this press trip. Honestly, I felt like the internet just loves some low-hanging fruit because those influencers really were low-hanging fruit. Like, are not the only ones. Now, they were righteous, and one particular person was incredibly righteous in there. You need to do your research, know the facts. They took me to a fake factory. You know, so I think the internet loves a little bit of hubris and Schadenfreude. And I also think people are on the edge of their seats because it happened right after that dreadful submarine incident. Did people pay attention to the submarine incident over here?
Oh, yes, they did.
We were captivated. Everyone was like, oh, my God. Steve told me you have to put down your phone. He was like, I can't hear any more stats about the submarine. So everybody was already on the edge of their seat after that and was like in their phone due to the submarine. And then, of course, you know, we got the really tragic news, what happened. And then the Shein thing happened right after it. So people were already like this, and it was like, oh, people just wanted a bit of relief. They wanted someone that they could like really like swing at. And that's why it got so much attention. But at the end of the day, I do feel like those influencers are low hanging fruit. Every person you follow that sells sweatshop goods should be criticized just as hard as they do. And it doesn't matter if it's a fancier sweatshop brand. If it's a sweatshop brand, it's still a sweatshop brand. So I think we're good at criticizing certain people when really we need to be fine-tooth combing every person on our feed that's selling something and asking ourselves, why is it that this person that has plenty of money is selling clothing from a brand that we all know exploits their workers? That's really it. We got to spread that shit around. Like, don't get me wrong. I definitely think that, like, the fury that came at them was pretty funny. But yeah. I also was like, it's low-hanging fruit. Look at every person with a brand partnership who's in your feed. Scrutinize them with the same magnifying glass.
And that means the celebrities that you
that
love.
That means the celebrities. That means, because at the end of the day, we do this thing, particularly with celebrities, where we'll be like, look at the celebrity I like wearing sweatshop clothing. She's a man of the people. Oh, they're just like me. They also pay $5 for their t-shirts, even though they're millionaires. What are we doing there? That's not relatable. That's garbage. If you have money to spend on nice clothing, you shouldn't be wearing clothing from brands that don't pay their workers. That's it. And we need to start scrutinizing celebrities. We need to start scrutinizing the people we follow where we really like them to the point where we probably feel a little parasocial towards them. And we have to sort of unpeel ourselves from that and actually look at what's being presented to us.
But there's an actual added layer of bullshit there, because the celebrities will wear a, you know, $20 t-shirt to say, I'm just like you.
Yeah.
But then they'll pair it with $2,000 shoes to say, actually, I'm not like you and you want to be like me.
I know, so right? It's a bit of whiplash, isn't
it? It's whiplash,
yeah.
Totally.
It's like, oh, I'm relatable, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But also aspirational, because, and this is a formula that I also see certain influencers replicate, where they'll be selling you, like, you know, Pretty Little Thing, and the outfit will be like, the leggings will be Pretty Little Thing, but then like the shoes will be Valentino, the handbag will be Dior, the sunglasses will be Alexander McQueen. But hey, poor person, you can have these $9 leggings that I'm going to wear once and throw away. Isn't that cool? So we're looking at this from like a real sort of aspirational standpoint, not realizing that you can't afford half the outfit. They're just selling you the shit, which quite frankly is condescending in my opinion.
Yeah. A question here from somebody in the audience. This is an interesting one. What's your view on concert merch and how much money they make for the artist and the record label?
You know, I'm not that bothered by it if the artist actually gives a shit about this stuff. And there are a lot of artists that do. There are a lot of musicians where they are, you know, really sort of manufacturing in really good ways. I mean, one good example, and I don't follow Harry Styles much, but I have been looking at a lot of the merch that he's doing, and he's doing some really cool things with sustainability, which I think is nice. So it's, again, looking at the labels, looking at where the stuff is made. And I do think that when it comes to concert merch, when it comes to stuff like that, I do think we tend to hang on to that stuff for longer for sentimental value. So I'm not here to ruin every single parade, but some of them I will ruin. But when it comes to that one in particular, I think it's, again, look at the artist and look at the merch, because oftentimes it will say, like, this was made in a fair trade factory and blah, 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 blah. That's great. I have no problem with you getting that stuff, but the stuff where you can't really find any sort of information about where it was made and who was paid and that sort of stuff. And I also think it's, again, like big corporations versus like, you know, small brands. Maybe you don't need to buy merch from the pop star that is a millionaire. You know, maybe you don't need to put more money into a billionaire's pocket. But for that small indie brand you like that has their friends making t-shirts, buy that t-shirt, you know?
Yeah. Talking about big and small companies, there's a question here about B Corp brands.
They are just handing out B Corp titles like participation trophies. Unfortunately, I think for like small brands, for instance, my friend Laura Jean, she has become a B Corp. That's amazing because it's really hard for a small brand. But then I saw that they also gave up B Corp to Nestle. Nestle.
So just explain B Corp for somebody that might not know what it is. It's kind of like a standard of...
It's a certification. It's a certification that... And the problem with the certifications across the board is you have a small brand that is going to have to pay a lot of money that they might not have, work really hard, come up with all this paperwork, where unfortunately, I do think for a lot of the certifications, it's becoming easier for the big brands to just buy their way in. So that's why everyone's like asking me about certifications. And I always say, once again, just take it with a grain of salt. Look for who is paying people fair wages. Look for that. Don't look for the certification. The certification's great. But when we get to a point where massive corporations are able to buy in, then I think we need to start looking a little bit deeper at some of the certifications. I don't know. I did say Nestle. I think it's Nescafe. But either way, that's owned by Nestle.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you get to a point where groups that are owned by groups that we know have done bad things can get certifications, we need to go a little bit deeper than certifications.
I think I heard you say somewhere that you started writing letters to CEOs.
When I was a kid.
When you were a kid.
Because I realized they would send you free stuff.
Okay, well, that strikes my next question, which was like, how did you get into social justice?
Oh, yeah. No, when I was a kid, I would be like, dear Mickey Drexel, he was like the CEO of J. Crew, and now he's the CEO of that company. They seem really cool, actually, and pretty like ethically made. I can't think of it. Alex Mills, now he's the CEO of that, but he was the CEO of J. Crew for many years. And I wrote him a little letter about a sweater that I had saved for, and he sent me a gift card because the sweater had a hole in it, and I thought, this is awesome. And then I just started to just write more CEOs. One time, my mom makes collard greens because she's Southern, and we had gotten some collard greens from Glory Greens, and they had a big old stick in them. She had cooked it, and there was a massive stick sticking out. So we wrote them a letter, and they sent her a massive gift basket of greens, and then they kept sending the gift baskets. It was like someone had like forgotten, or like they had like typed their name into a system, and we just kept getting greens and greens and greens. And it's like, enough greens. But yeah, I was the family letter writer. Someone would be like, "Oh, so this thing broke. You know what to do."
Where do you think this drive, because it's not actually only just fashion that you advocate for and around. I mean, it's colonialism, it's anti-racism, it's, you know, being able to kind of live and thrive in a bigger body. It's all of these things. So there must be a sort of a driver to you wanting to fight or push for these causes. What do you think drives that?
I want all of us to have a good life. I want you to have a good life. I want your neighbor to have a good life. I want us all to just have a little bit of ease. I want us all to give ourselves a break. These systems, they're making us feel so crappy. They're trashing our planet. They make us feel less than. I just want you to have a good life, y'all. And I want the people that make your clothing to have a good life, too. That's really it. Awesome.
Looking for the Good Life is fashion activist and writer Aja Baba. She was speaking to journalist and presenter Jan Fran about all things fast fashion. Her book is called Consumed, on colonialism, climate change, consumerism and the need for collective change. Big thanks to the All About Women Festival and the Sydney Opera House for that fantastic event. That brings us to the end of this episode of Big Ideas. Great to have your company today. The show is produced by Claire Slattery, Karen Zivanovic, and myself. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can find Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app, our full archive of episodes. We'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.